accession number 18003, reel 2.
Ron Yasman, reel 2.
Was back at A echelon, and it was too far away to get to it. There were no facilities for anybody, our own B echelon, to get back to recover this stuff for us. Our own quartermaster didn't have supplies coming through to him, except food, and as I said, that was supplied by the Americans. Boots were wearing out. Feet beginning to ache because of nails coming through the boots. No cobbler available. By this time, I hadn't had a wash bath, or I'd had a wash in a every morning, washed our faces and shaved and washed our hands, but our body was getting a bit smellies. We had no change of underclothes except what we wore, because we couldn't carry everything. Ammunition and food, blanket. Some people had sleeping bags, others had two blankets, half a tent. We had to carry all our ammunition. And as a Bren gun, you carried six magazines in your pouches, and you carried six magazines in supplementary pouches around your waist. You had probably 40 to 50 pounds on your back by the time everything was taken into consideration, your mess tins. Those of us that had spare socks and odd items all went into one pack. I mean, you could, and whatever you wanted, you had to carry. Nothing like I'd been trained for. I mean, I'd been trained. My army training was for normal, what soldiers normally thought was battlefield conditions, flat countryside. In Korea, there was no such thing as flat countryside, not for long anyway. It just hilly country, and you walked along a road, got to your battle position, and you went up a hill. The following day, once you got up the hill, you came down the hill again. And if you was advancing again, you went up the hill again. And everything that you had to be carried. If you were being supported by any support company, like mortars or machine guns, you had to help them, because their equipment was very heavy and they had to manhandle it themselves. If possible, you had one or maybe two mortar bombs in addition to your normal weight. It's quite strenuous at times. Some of the hills were quite big, and by the time you got halfway up, you was out of breath. Altitude sickness, if you like, but that wasn't until later on. But it was very tiring. After doing what we had to do during the day, and come night time after we dug in, there was no question of sleeping all night. It was a question of 2 hours in the slit trench, 2 hours behind it under your pup tent, then 2 hours back in the slit trench. Later on, when the winter closed in, it became even more strenuous then, because you just couldn't sleep at night, and we used to work little fiddles between ourselves, although the company commander probably knew it was going on, but turned a blind eye as long as those that were awake were alert.
What were the little fiddles?
Well, there was always two of you together on the Bren gun. So you'd do 2 hours in the slit trench. For the first quarter of an hour, both of you would stay awake, and then one of you would dust down in the bottom of the trench, just sit down in the bottom of the trench for maybe half an hour, and then he'd kick the other one. But the other one would stay awake, then he'd kick him and wake up, and then you'd take your turn of half an hour in the trench. And then you were relieved and you went back in your little pup tent and had your 2 hours sleep. So that would go on till first light, and about half an hour before first light, it was everybody was staying too. And then everybody was awake. You get your first cup of tea of the day. Sometimes when we were lucky, it was laced with rum, so it wasn't too bad. As I said, boots were wearing out, feet were sore, back aching. Everybody was tired, people getting niggly. But once they started to move and you got your breakfast inside you, it wasn't too bad again. People became friendly again. And then we got to Kimpo. There we had a couple of days rest and we met up with our other battalion of the 27 Brigade that had joined. It was the 3rd Australian Regiment. So that made the 27 Brigade was the Middlesex, the 3rd Australian Regiment, and the Argyles. And this time, I suppose, it was October, November time, and we had a battery, our own artillery joined us, rather than using the American artillery. It was a New Zealand battery of artillery. And then we had a medical field ambulance unit, which was all Indian. And around about that time, we started being called the Commonwealth Brigade. Originally, it was just 27 Brigade. It consisted of the Argyles and the Middlesex. And then the 3rd Australian Regiment joined us, as I said. Then the New Zealanders. Then the Indian hospital unit. So we became a real independent brigade. The Americans, for some reason or other, seemed to use 27 Brigade as a general dog's body. When their armour was pushing forward, they tend to stick to the roads, the Americans, for some reason or other. And when we got to a rest area during the evenings, just before dark, because by this time we were getting 12, 13 hours of darkness a day, and then later became about 16 hours of darkness. We'd get to a halt for the night. The Americans would bed down on the side of the road, and poor old Argyles, or the Middlesex, would get pushed up on the hills, so it was another hour or so before we could sit down, and we'd get a bit cheesed off with this and wondering why. Later on... through certain circumstances, we were glad that our officers had done this. The Americans didn't seem to be able to fight as a unit in small groups. They tend to fight as a larger unit all the time. Whereas in the British Army, they seem to use smaller groups, but independently, rather than charge by numbers.
Did you prefer the British method?
Oh, much. Much so, very much so. You were independent. You could think for yourself to a certain extent. But the Americans, they would send a platoon of men to do a certain job, whereas in the British Army they would only send a section of men to do exactly the same job. And my philosophy was, the less the numbers, the less chance you've got of being seen. The more of you are, the greater chance there are of being seen. We had a few days rest at Kimpo, then we started on the move again, and we went up to a place called Sariwon, which was in North Korea's big industrial town. And it appeared empty when we got there. A company commander at that time was Major Gordon Ingram, and the 2IC was Colin Mitchell, and they'd moved us. Well, me and my platoon were in some railway sidings, and the place was deserted, and the 2IC and the company commander went around looking in the Bren gun carrier, and it was a funny incident. There was a lorry coming down the road, and all of a sudden the lorry stopped, and Captain Mitchell was in the Bren gun carrier, and they looked at each other, and it was a North Korean lorry full of North Korean soldiers, and everybody panicked. Well, they didn't actually panic, they scarpered, took cover between various vehicles, as a jeep, and a little gunfight ensued, and then suddenly one of the lads, I don't know, I think he was from 6th Platoon, just whipped along this gully and lobbed a grenade in the back of the truck, and that was the back of that. There were some Koreans that had jumped out of the lorry earlier when it had stopped, before this, I don't know who it was, lobbed this grenade in, and they went down the gully down the other side of the road, and that's where they stayed. They got caught there by some gunfire, and that was it.
From the Argyles?
From the Argyles, yeah, it was from B Company, our company. I don't know who it was, who lobbed a grenade in, but he took a risk running along that gully on one side of the road and lobbed a grenade in. But it certainly livened things up a bit.
But what about the ones who had escaped from the lorry?
They were in the gully on the opposite side of the road, and I think it was 4th Platoon that were that side of the road. They just opened fire down the gully, along with a company commander and 2IC, and finished off the rest of the Koreans who were laying there.
Were there any casualties to the Argyles in that action?
None. It was a big sigh of relief. Anyway, we pulled out. The Koreans had in actual fact deserted the place, although they were sending up reinforcements. The reinforcements hadn't realised that the position had been vacated by the North Koreans, so it was a bit dodgy for a time, with people flooding back, the North Koreans flooding back in. They pulled us out of the railway sidings and to the edge of the town, and the following day something very similar happened, but this happened with support company. They were going along, and they had exactly the same experience. They were going forward with their carrier and their mortars, with the mortar officer, Robin Ferry, and they didn't fight or anything at all like that. The Koreans started saying "Ruski, Ruski, Ruski," and Robin Ferry and the boys in the back were going "Ya, ya, ya," and nothing happened. As soon as they got through this patrol that they sent down, they were off the road and they scarpered. But the reason they were mistaken, I should imagine, because none of us had worn our tam o'shanters. We were all wearing cap comforters, which is a scarf folded in and rolled up like a bonnet, and you just put it on your head to keep your head warm. And they just looked like the Russian fur hats that you see pictures of the Russian soldiers. And they mistook the support company, the mortar platoon, for Russian soldiers.
But there was no firing on that
occasion? No firing on that occasion. And then the following day, again, Captain Mitchell and Major Penman, I think it was, who'd come back, although Gordon Ingram was still company commander. Major Penman had come back after being wounded. They went up the road again, exactly the same area, Sariwon, but towards the other side of the town. And they came across more reinforcements of North Koreans coming down exactly the same road, but farther up. And but the gunfight started that time, and Captain Mitchell and his escort just went straight through. And after a time, they didn't fire anymore. North Koreans stopped firing. And they went straight through. And first chance I had, they got off the road and scarpered and stayed there all night and came back the following morning. No Koreans in sight, North Koreans in sight then. But they had deployed into the hills, the North Koreans, in front of us, and we could see them walking along the outline. And again, we opened fire on them, and they went to ground, and we called napalm down. And again, by the time we got through, there were no one there. And from there, we continued our steady march. All the way up, we got to Pyongyang. One or two small skirmishes, nothing really serious. Then made our way up.
What was Pyongyang like?
Pyongyang was flattened, the area I went through, although the whole town wasn't completely destroyed. I don't know how the other companies got on or what they done, but as I said, we were independent small units most of the time. And the area I went through had been flattened, very little trouble. Then we continued up and down hills. By this time, feet were bleeding, nails through the boots, couldn't get them repaired. Me having big feet, I couldn't get a size 10. Plenty of small boots available, but no big boots. And I eventually acquired a pair from we stopped to pick up rations one day, and I saw a pair of large boots laying around, and I just picked them up. The American calf-length boots, just picked them up, and hoping that they would fit. And the first opportunity I had, I tried them on, and a bit too big, but an extra pair of socks. Soon got rid of that. So I had decent feet again. From there, we carried on straight up to Chongju. And this is the area that I'm thankful that we didn't have our sleeping in the road like the Americans. We got to this place called Chongju, and we'd had a bit of a firefight to get there. Again, there were no casualties. A company who was on one of our flanks had lost 2 killed and 5 wounded, I think, at that particular day. Anyway, we'd had a ride on a tank that day to get forward a bit, and the Americans, once they'd stopped for the evening, because it was getting dark, And again, we went up the hills again to take up machines at the top of the hills. And we were a bit too far advanced. Anyway, there was a North Korean patrol had caught the Americans sound asleep in their sleeping bags on the road. And by the time we came down the following day, or the time we advanced the following day, we had no support. We had to wait for American transport, etc., and so on, to catch up with us, because they'd all been caught in their sleeping bags. Most of them had their throats cut.
Did you see the bodies?
I saw one body. It's a bit sickening. But by the time we got down there, most of the bodies had been removed by the American casualty people, the medics, although they hadn't had time to clear them all by the time we got there. Then
was this in a built-up area or out in the
countryside? No, out in the countryside. I mean, the villages were few and far between in the hills. Most of the villages were on the roads. They were mostly wooden construction with tiled roofs, some of them were thatch. But I'm afraid the Americans did tend to do that, to sleep undercover, rather than be out in the open. We did sleep undercover now and again, but these were under very controlled conditions. There were always your sentries out, always your outposts out. By the time we got to Chongju, everybody was tired. Semi-bad tempered, although morale was good. There was always jokes and laughter, but generally speaking, there was always a whinge when we were going to move. As usual, soldiers complain, "Am I going to get a rest? Am I going to get a rest?" But we kept on moving. Then. Then we got, as I say, we got to Chongju, and then a little bit farther up, we come to some really big hills, and this is where the I've forgotten what the hell they call it.
Give me a clue. The Yellow River?
No. Height sickness.
Altitude sickness?
Altitude sickness, yeah. I think this is where the altitude sickness became, to some people anyway, who didn't have strong lungs, or when we started climbing up the bigger hills, some people did have this altitude sickness. Although this is, with hindsight, we didn't know what it was then. The people, when they got up to this height, 6,000 or 7,000 feet, they were really knackered, probably because they were carrying huge weights as well. I mean, but they just didn't have any. We had what we used to call a gook train, which was Korean porters that were used to bring up supplies, but like us, they could only carry so much, and they normally only had one or maybe two persons in charge of them, and there might be anything up to 40 or 50 porters bringing the stuff up, but then again, you couldn't rely on them. Once you got the stuff, you shared it out among them, you had to carry it yourselves.
In what way could you not rely on them?
Conditions. He didn't know if they were North or South Korean. They couldn't be trusted, that was for sure. This was in North Korea. And you just couldn't trust them. Their uniforms were funny. In a couple of instances, by this time it was getting late and snow was on the ground, and the North Koreans had padded uniforms. They were like K-pop trousers and K-pop jackets, and inside was white, outside was khaki, and they were reversible. So you could see a khaki figure running from you in the distance, you take a shot at him, and he'd dive under cover or dive into the village or something, and by the time you got into the village, there were no khaki in sight, everybody was wearing white. We caught one or two of them, but took several prisoners in this manner. Whether they were actually North Koreans or not, I couldn't tell. But we just captured them, bundled them all together, then handed them back to the intelligence people, and they decided if they were North Korean or South Korean. That was one of the troubles in North Korea. If you saw a couple of people in white uniforms in the distance, it was very difficult to know whether to fire on them or not. Because they could have been civilians, because civilians wore these white padded dresses, or the women dressed the same as the men, and you couldn't tell from a distance whether they were male or female. All you could see was a white, maybe half a dozen white uniforms. Now, is that a Korean patrol or isn't it? Unfortunately, he didn't take a chance, so he just opened fire on them. That I don't know what, because we were moving and that was it. You didn't bother. If any of your own were wounded, that was okay. You looked after them, or if any of your own were killed, you took their ID tags. And marked, gave a rough map reference where their body was located. But with the North Koreans, you just couldn't tell, so you just opened fire anyway. If they were in a village, and if there was a village in the area, you didn't open fire, you just done your normal duty and took the village, whatever, and then all the people that were in the village were then interrogated by the intelligence services. Normally a couple of ROK officers that could speak in ROK, being Republic of Korea, South Korean Army, they acted as interpreters and intelligence officers. We just handed them over to them and the whole village and let them sort it out and just move on. We got up to the Yellow River eventually.